Good morning, everyone. Thank you for your attention. At this time, please turn off all electronic devices for the duration of the court session. Photography and/or video recording not previously authorized are prohibited. The court will now convene. Before it does, I will ask you to rise as the judges enter the court. Argument by counsel may take up to 1 hour and 20 minutes. Upon conclusion, the judges will officially adjourn the court in place and the Q&A session will commence. At the conclusion of the Q&A, I will again ask you to rise as the judges depart. Upon their departure, you are invited to join them for a reception. At the reception, you will have an opportunity to meet the judges and counsel here today. I will also be available to answer any questions you may have about a career in the Air Force JAG Corps. The court will now convene. The Chief Judge and Judges of the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. Hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals, draw near, for the court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Please be seated. The court is called to order. As part of Project Outreach, we are hearing oral argument today at M State Law School. The court calls the case of United States v. Senior Airman Troy C. Hodge, number ACM 39259. In today's oral argument, we consider whether the military judge erred by allowing the government's expert to testify regarding appellant's recidivism during sentencing in a multi-victim sexual assault case. Appellant's counsel, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, 5 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you. You may proceed.
Good afternoon, Chief Judge Mayberry, members of the court, may it please the court. I and Captain Megan Glines-Barney, and along with Major Patrick Clary, represent the appellant, Senior Airman Troy C. Hodge. This court should hold that the military judge erred by allowing Dr. M.C. to testify regarding recidivism utilizing the Static 2002-9R actuarial assessment during appellant's pre-sentencing hearing. This testimony was inadmissible under MRE 702 and RCM 1001. Dr. M.C.'s testimony is inadmissible under MRE 702D because there is no reliable evidence that the assessment accounted for appellant's sexual orientation, which according to the assessment increased appellant's risk of recidivism, and the expert could not provide any explanation regarding. Moreover, even if it is found to be admissible under MRE 702, the testimony is inadmissible under RCM 1001B5 because the result of the actuarial assessment is an overall statistical understanding of recidivism for sex offenders as a general population. It did not take into account appellant's personal circumstances as is required for providing a basis for an opinion, and branded all male-on-male assaults to be per se deviant, which all combined, the military judge concurred, was highly prejudicial. MRE 702 governs the admissibility of expert testimony. 702D is the issue specifically in front of the court today, as it asks whether the witness applied the principles and methods reliably to the facts of this case. And in that, under that heading, that cannot be said for appellant's court-martial. During the testimony, the government called Dr. M.C. to testify regarding recidivism, of which he was going to use the Static 2002-R actuarial assessment. This assessment looked at the general population of sex offenders as a whole and broke groups into a low risk of reoffending, a low to moderate risk of reoffending, moderate, moderate to high, and high. And under that assessment, it stated that there was a risk of that population as a whole reoffending. It wasn't specific to the individual at hand. Now, when Dr. M.C. was called to testify during the Dobe hearing, he was crossed by the defense regarding his knowledge of the assessment and particularly how it was going to impact a homosexual individual, as the appellant was known to be at that point in the trial. The concern there was that under this assessment, it's broken into 13 questions. Some of the questions ask about the age of an individual, so Dr. MC could explain that if an individual is incredibly young, that their brain is not developed, there are chemical issues, and they would be more likely to reoffend. It talked about the persistence of a sexual offender, which included questions like the rate of sexual offending. Has somebody offended in the past before? And then the third category was deviant sexual interest. And under deviant sexual interest, there are three questions. The first is whether there was any sentencing occasion in the past for a non-contact sexual offense. The third had to do with the types of victims. So it was having two or more minor victims under the age of 12 for this assessment, and one of them being unrelated to the offender. But the one at issue here was number six, where it asked if any of the victims were male. So it does not matter, according to this assessment, whether it's one male victim, whether there are 10 male victims, whether there are 9 female victims and one male victim. If there's one male victim, then that person receives that additional point, and it's on a negative 2 to 13 point scale. Now, the concern here is that, therefore, any male offender who is homosexual and is in an offense in which it involves sexual gratification will automatically receive that point. This is in contrast to a male offender who is heterosexual and offends against a female, and he wouldn't fall under that deviant category, so he would not receive that point regardless, which is why the sexual orientation of the offender comes into play here. So when the defense was cross-examining Dr. MC, they asked him specifically about his knowledge of the assessment when it came to homosexual offenders. He was asked if he knew if the test took into consideration the sexual orientation of the offender, to which he stated he did not. He was asked if there were any assessments that he knew of that considered homosexuality for recidivism, to which he explained he did not. They asked him regarding male offenders specifically who offended against other males, and he admitted that in cases in which the male offender is a pedophile who is attracted to and offends against minor males, that it increases the risk of recidivism. So the question they then asked was, okay, so pedophiles, male-on-male pedophile cases, are going to increase this risk of recidivism. You cannot tell us anything about heterosexual males who offend against males, and you can't tell us anything about homosexual males who offend against males. So at this point, how do we know what the impact is? And Dr. MC was unable to provide any information. During his actual testimony in front of members, not during the Dobie hearing, he was able to give explanations when I mentioned age, unrelatedness of victims. He gave specific information, and that's where I received that knowledge from, is from Dr. MC's testimony. But when it came to talking about this question number six, the risk of recidivism for anyone with a male victim, his response was specifically, sometimes that's what the science tells you and you have to accept it. He compared it to insurance rates, where women are considered to have a lower risk of accident, and therefore women at a certain age pay a lower insurance premium. But when he was asked specifically, can you give any information, can you give any explanation, can you differentiate a male attracted to underage males or a heterosexual male who offends against a male, he was unable to provide any reliable or relevant testimony as to why this mattered. And this becomes incredibly concerning, because the conclusion that comes from this is that any male who offends against other males is per se deviant, per the heading that was discussed between trial counsel and Dr. MC. The word deviant or deviance was used 17 times during the testimony in front of members. And what this says to the members who are listening to an expert's testimony is that any male-on-male offender is per se deviant, and any homosexual male who has offended against an individual that he has some sort of attraction to is therefore also per se deviant, which causes the concern that a heterosexual male offending against somebody he's sexually attracted to does not fall under this category, would not have the word deviant used in association with his sexual crimes. But it does, in this case, with this appellant. And therefore, if the proponent of the testimony, if the government, if Dr. MC himself cannot provide any specific evidence or testimony as to the fact that this is not going to negatively impact the assessment and its understanding, its application to the appellant, then it isn't able to be reliably applied to appellant's case. The government relies heavily on Ellis and Amador, as well as Merritt, which addressed the static 99 assessment, which is the predecessor to the static 2002. And each of those cases, I would like to point out, are different than appellant's case. In each of those cases, they're different for two primary reasons. One is that each of those cases was heard by military judge alone. They were not members' cases. And in that, per Ellis, in the concurrence by Judge Baker, he stated that that was important because a military judge is expected to understand the difference between an assessment that says 10% of this population of people are likely to reoffend as opposed to this individual has a 10% likelihood of reoffending. He also stated specifically that facts needed to be considered because in each of these cases, they were also heterosexual male offenders offending against minor females. So at no point in any of these cases is there a homosexual offender or does this actual issue, this actual concern arise. Additionally, those objections were based under 1001 primarily in that the expert didn't have the basis for grounding an opinion because specifically they hadn't actually interviewed the appellant is in what most of those cases address. Whereas here, the issue isn't about whether Dr. MC interviewed appellant, which he did not.
Did he have to?
No. No, Your Honor, he does not. However, the question here is based on 702 and whether he was actually able to reliably use this assessment with the facts of appellant's case, whether it's able to be applied in his circumstance. Because just as if appellant had been a female, this assessment couldn't have been used on him because this assessment didn't consider females when the assessment was developed. Females are not part of the statistics. There's no information that demonstrates that these statistics can reliably be applied to women.
Or adolescents, correct?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Or adolescents.
And similarly, without any evidence that homosexuals are even included in that study were even considered. There's no testimony by Dr. Chambers. In fact, there's testimony to the opposite by Dr. Chambers that he doesn't believe that it was considered. He wasn't aware of whether sexual orientation was considered. And the basis, the assumption, is that these offenders under the static 2002 are heterosexual.
Is it an assumption or is it based on data?
He could not give any specific information. His belief was that it was a presumption. At least that is his testimony.
Didn't he, in fact, testify that he knows that the sexual orientation is not a question that is asked as part of applying the test to a particular individual?
It is not one of the questions, no, Your Honor. But it is a question which brings that to the surface. When there is a question that specifically asks, is it a male offender, or is there a male victim, that does bring into question what the basis of that offense connection is.
Understanding the implications of the answer to the question is primarily where you're focusing, but is it your testimony here, your argument here today, that because we don't ask that question, Dr. Chambers was saying that the homosexual population was excluded from the data that was gathered as part of the assessments historically?
And Your Honor, that's part of the issue. We don't have an answer to that. We don't know per Dr. Chambers' testimony whether they were excluded. We don't know per Dr. Chambers' testimony if they were included. As you pointed out, I believe Dr. Chambers stated specifically that that wasn't anything he was aware had even been considered. The problem with that is if it's not considered, if we don't know if it can be applied appropriately, then the party bringing the testimony forward, the party with the burden of demonstrating that this actuarial assessment can be used reliably in this case, is unable to just demonstrate that it is, and therefore it should have been kept out.
How would your answer change if Dr. Chambers said that the data included homosexual assessment historic numbers?
If Dr. Chambers had, Dr. MC, I apologize, had been able to testify specifically saying that homosexual offenders were included in this assessment, that they were, that the numbers applied to them appropriately as well, that, you know, they were part of this actuarial mathematical test, then it wouldn't be at issue. But the fact is Dr. MC told us effectively the middle of that. You know, he didn't say the opposite, that they weren't. He didn't say specifically that they were. But as the proponent of the evidence, when he stands up and says, I can't tell you one way or another if they were or not, he's not meeting the burden to say that this testimony, this assessment as a whole, is going to be able to adequately be applied to the appellant.
And the assessment as a whole relies upon static factors, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
That are scored.
Yes, Your Honor.
And I know we're talking about one specifically, but couldn't you make certain, I guess, similar arguments about some of the other factors? Well, hey, we're not really looking at, you know, age as it pertains to this specific individual. They were raised in a certain household, so we need to look. I mean, this actuarial assessment is supposed to put aside a lot of those dynamic factors, correct?
Yes, sir.
So are you saying, you know, sir, are you can make this type of argument as it relates to all of these static factors? Are you saying that an actuarial assessment has no place in courts martial?
There are concerns about, I have concerns about an actuarial assessment being used in court-martial. It's taken directly out of the concurrence in Ellis, where our sentencing procedures are supposed to be individualized. We are supposed to look at the individual, the offense, and by using an actuarial assessment, we're merely turning it into a mathematical calculation that says, because this individual meets these characterizations, then they have this risk of reoffending. Which is contrary to our historical practices when it comes to sentencing.
So is your argument that the 2002 R is defective with regard to this factor, whether there are male victims or not, across the board, or only as it applies to a case where you have a homosexual offense?
Your Honor, I'm not arguing that the static 2002 R is ineffective as a whole. Our argument is more that if we cannot have our experts who are testifying as the proponents of these evidence can specifically say that these questions, these categories that increase the risk of recidivism, if they can't answer to why it will increase the risk of recidivism, if they can't answer to how it applies to a certain population of people, then there are significant concerns about its applicability in those cases.
So if I understand your point, your concern is that the expert wasn't able to explain why this might be the case for homosexual offenders or not, because he wasn't aware of specific studies that examined that. Is that fair?
Yes, Your Honor, because he wasn't aware of specific studies, because he wasn't aware of the impact that it would have, because in each of the other sections he can give some sort of psychological explanation as to why these are relevant, and when it comes to this one factor that is effectively the most important, and he ends up testifying the bulk of his testimony, which is actually the bulk of the government sentencing case itself, is him talking about this deviant sexual interest involving a male victim, about how that applies to how it correlates with the persistence of sexual reoffending. And so when you look at all of that combined, it becomes very problematic that the one thing that he talks about most, that the one issue that is truly at odds in this assessment as a whole, is the one that he has no explanation for, cannot give any science behind.
All right. And to follow up a little bit, so is there anything that we can look at in the record that would indicate that what the 2002 R purports to account for with regard to this factor is sort of a binary, where they're male victims or not, understanding that it doesn't specifically go down to the next level and doesn't assess, as the expert said, the sexual orientation of the offender? It's just looking at what the victims were, what their gender, rate, or sex was. is there anything that indicates that what it purports to measure it is invalid or that that's inaccurate, that the data indicates, per the expert studies and the testimony, that this is a valid measure? And to follow up, if that's the case, why isn't it sufficient for, on cross-examination, for the opposing party to bring out these distinctions and point out the things that might not be accounted for, and to put that before the members?
Your Honor, there isn't anything in the record specifically indicating the contrary of that. The defense did have an expert. He did not testify. But the problem at the point of Dr. MC testifying and the defense cross-examining him is that, effectively, at that point, the bell can't be unrung. This information has been heard by the members. They are now have been given the understanding and the explanation by an expert whose CV has been published to them, who they are aware has a significant amount of knowledge and expertise in this area, that his understanding and that his explanation is that anyone who falls under this deviant category is going to have a higher risk of recidivism. And so regardless of the fact that during voir dire, sexual orientation was in-depthly reviewed by members, he's telling them that even if you don't have this belief that homosexuals are more likely to reoffend, the science says it is. And so that becomes incredibly prejudicial to the appellant. It causes there to be significant questions as to the impact that that would have on a sentence, as they're being told that that's acceptable information and that's science.
But doesn't case law suggest that even shaky science, I think they use the adjective, should be challenged on cross-examination?
And yes, Your Honor, it should be. And it was challenged on cross-examination. But the problem is that this testimony doesn't apply in this case. It doesn't apply to it can't be applied to appellant adequately, and so therefore it never should have been heard by the members. Just like if it had been applied to a female, yes, they could have crossed them on the fact that it shouldn't have been applied to a female, but at the end of the day, the members would have still heard a female is per se deviant if her victim was male.
You mentioned prejudice as it relates to other evidence. I mean, there was other evidence presented in this case at sentencing, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And I think, was it Judge Posner said that he didn't believe an actuarial assessment like the static 99 or 2002R should be the beginning and end of a sentencing case, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And it wasn't in this case, was it?
No, Your Honor. However, it was the vast majority. There was a short amount of testimony by the two named victims and the spouse of the victim, but it was less than a third, page-wise, and I understand that page-wise doesn't really, but it was still less than a third. The testimony of those three individuals was still less than a third of the testimony of this expert who was qualified as an expert who had testified during findings. So that third doesn't even take into account his actual expertise and the entire process of qualifying him as an expert. And additionally, when it came to the other sentencing evidence, it was specifically his PDS and his EPRs. So it was, well, not the sole factor in the sentencing case, it was the majority of the government's sentencing case.
And even understanding some arguments you've made and pointing to some of the portions of the record, we're still dealing with abuse of discretion.
Yes, sir.
So how are the judge's findings of fact unsupported by the record in this case?
With regard to the judge's findings of facts, they were primarily conclusory in nature. They were generally the repetition of the expert statements and were very limited to, in this case, and the military judge said, and finally, whether the expert had reliably applied the principles and methods, the facts of this case. Again, hearing Dr. MC's proposed testimony that I anticipate elicited, the expert has reliably applied the principles and methods of facts of this case. It was purely conclusory in nature. There was no analysis explaining why he believed that it applied appropriately. And so less deference should be given in a case such as this where he doesn't give any analysis.
Or announce or articulate his 403 balancing test on the record.
Yes, Your Honor. And if I may, I know I'm running out of time, I would like to shortly at least address RCM 1001B5. Under that assessment, it requires that in order to form a basis for an opinion, it must relate to his personal circumstances. Again, with the set of 2002R, the problem becomes that this assessment overall is just a general look at the general sex offender population and which category he falls into based on this numerical assessment. And per the concurrence in Ellis, that is the same issue as before, that it looks merely at statistics and numbers and takes away from that individualized sentencing proceeding that the military is so dedicated to, not only through our rules, but our case law. And this just becomes incredibly prejudicial when you look at the 403 balancing test because of the use of the word deviance several times, 17 times in front of members. 17 times he used deviant or deviance to explain and describe the appellant. They branded, therefore, the appellant in front of these members as a deviant over and over and over, which among psychological professionals, among even legal professionals, we understand that deviant just means abnormal. But in this case, in general language, deviance has a very negative connotation among the general population in our regular daily language, and therefore it kind of indicated that this is worse than normal. Even when we look into consideration that under the same category, if an individual offends against their own biological child, that doesn't fall under that category. And so there are significant concerns that this has effectively inflamed the fears of a panel of members, which 4 out of 5 were male. They were generally fairly senior in rank, which means that they'd been in the military prior to Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And there are concerns that when they're told effectively, don't question the math, don't question the science, just accept that this is what this is, and that is what we have been told, that appellant was over-sentenced or given a harsher sentence strictly because of this assessment and the branding that Dr. MC and the government applied to him as part of it. There are no further questions?
Just briefly, you said don't question the math. Isn't that what cross-examination is for?
Yes, Your Honor, and when cross-examined on that, he was told, accept the math. That is what the math says. There are no further questions. That's my presentation.
Thank you, counsel. Amicus counsel, on behalf of the appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you, Chief Judge Mayberry, and Your Honors, may it please the court. I'm Matthew Somaska, accepting this court's invitation to appear as amicus on behalf of the appellant, Senior Airman Hodge. We respectfully request that Senior Airman Hodge's sentence be vacated and he be granted a new sentencing hearing before the military judge because the military judge failed in two ways. First, the military judge failed in his role as gatekeeper in admitting scientific recidivism evidence in violation of Rule 702, the admission of which was highly prejudicial, and the prejudicial impact of the evidence substantially outweighed its probative value. Military courts have adopted the structure for admitting expert evidence under Rule 702 as developed by Daubert and Hauser, both of which contain what's colloquially known as a fit requirement, meaning that the recidivism evidence must be, the methods and principles of the evidence must be reliably applied to the facts of the case. Unfortunately, that was not done here. United States versus Billings is the most on-point case we have where scientific evidence was rejected for its unreliability as applied to that case. In Billings, it dealt with the identification of a gold-plated watch from a photograph. Very similarly to what happened here, we had little more than a mere resuscitation of the Daubert factors in Billings. And the judge in Billings was found to have abused his discretion as a gatekeeper in admitting that evidence. Upon a Daubert objection, it is the government's burden to show this fit requirement, that the principles and methods are reliably applied. And it has to be shown by more than the mere ipse dixit testimony of the expert. Unfortunately, no studies were introduced by Dr. MC as to the reliability and validity of this model, and no studies were introduced showing that the STAT of 2002R has been peer-reviewed. All of these claims were generally proffered by the expert. By his sole Itse Dixit testimony. This is at the record at 894 and 928. And again, strikingly similar as in Billings, the record at 940, we have little more than a mere resuscitation of the Daubert factors. We also argue that the Daubert hearing was erroneously terminated and defense counsel was unable to conduct further inquiry as to Dr. MC's own methodology in application of this actuarial tool to Senior Airman Hodge. The military judge sustained an objection on the fit of the model. This is at the record at 922 and 924, and told defense counsel that she had to focus on validity alone of the model. Every single study in the record, Your Honors, was authored by Dr. Carl Hansen, who is the very creator of the static 2002R model. We argue thus that that's not peer review. Those are self-serving studies that doesn't meet the peer review factor of either Daubert or Hauser. Additionally, in the Daubert hearing, we only have, and in the record, we only have the coding rules for the 2002 actuarial tool, not the actual 2002R, which was used against Senior Airman Hodge. We don't have those coding rules in the record, Your Honors. The expert admitted to knowing of no studies regarding the recidivism rates of military sex offenders, and he admitted to knowing no studies as to the recidivism rate of homosexuals. That's at the record at 989. Both the majority and the concurrence in Ellis say that the admissibility of this type of evidence must be made on a case-by-case and factual-specific basis. And there's three primary ways Ellis is distinguishable from here. First, Ellis involved child sex abuse. Dr. MC admitted that most of the offenders studied in the statistics for this model were child sex offenders. That's at the record at 926, similar to the accused in Stinson, Flesher, Fry, Latour, and Amador. In fact, Your Honors, we've been unable to find any case in the federal system or even in state courts where this sort of actuarial tools have been applied to a homosexual offender with adult male victims. Additionally, the sentencing analysis was done by a military judge. Judge Baker's concurrence, along with the statement about how military judges are better known to understand critical distinctions with these tools, Judge Baker warned against reducing defendants down to mere robots being sentenced by a fixed formula. And that's what we're afraid happened here. Lastly, Ellis involved use of the Static 99 tool, not the Static 2002R. Dr. MC even testified that the Static 99 is still the most used actuarial tool and that there's not as much research done on the 2002R. That's at the record at 904 and 905. The prejudicial impact of this recidivism evidence substantially outweighed its probative value, potentially confusing the members. The military judge even stated on the record at 943 that this evidence is very prejudicial. Despite his own acknowledgement, the military judge gave no limiting instruction or provided any other curative measures for the members of the panel. The expert testified for 35 out of 68 pages of trial testimony. This is far more than any of the other government's witnesses. And we argue that this is violative of United States versus Scott, Your Honors, where it says this sort of recidivism evidence must come in for a limited purpose and a limited time. Perhaps most egregiously, Dr. MC used his own Itse Dixit definitions of factors on the coding sheet. For example, deviant sexual interest, as defined by the studies on this model, is defined as attractions to sexual acts that are illegal. But Dr. MC testified that it's defined as discomfort with one's own sexuality. This is highly prejudicial given Senior Airman Hodge's homosexuality and his statement that he struggled with his sexual identity in the past. Dr. Chambers also testified at length about impulse control. Despite impulse control not being explicitly on the coding sheet at all. The government and Dr. MC said they were going to use these coding sheet factors, and that was it. But that's not what happened, Your Honors. What happened there was unrestricted tangential testimony regarding lack of impulse control, we also argue that's violative of Rule of Courts Martial 1001. And while cross-examination may have been insufficient, we argue that this court is still able to reverse upon a finding of plain error. And we argue we have plain error here, given the military judge's explicit acknowledgement that this evidence is very prejudicial, his lack of any curative measure or limiting instruction for the jury, the fact that the Daubert hearing was erroneously terminated, and ultimately there was basically a prejudgment of the 403 balancing. If cross-examination is always sufficient for these types of errors, then that effectively renders Daubert toothless, Your Honors. We also anticipate opposing counsel to argue that this was harmless error because he only got 1 point and remained in the same category. We argue that the point or absence of a point here is not directly correlated to Senior Airman Hodges' sentence. The test is not flawed because he received an extra point, but the test, as applied to Senior Airman Hodge, and the unrestricted testimony of Dr. MC was flawed and it was prejudicial, because there's no way to know if the members were swayed by Dr. MC's ipse dixit testimony, and it was highly likely that they were confused regarding impulse control and deviant sexual behavior, given his ipse dixit definitions of those terms.
Where did Dr. MC get the information or receive the information regarding impulse control?
Your Honor, impulse control, he did state, was a function of antisocial behavior. But if you look at the record and if you look at the testimony, it's as if impulse control was its own factor, despite the fact that it's not an explicit factor, but that's all he testified to.
But in terms of evidence in impulse control, who discussed having issues with impulse control?
Your Honor, I believe the expert testified as to impulse control and argued that applied it to Senior Airman Hodge and said that he struggled with impulse control, and there was ambiguity because Senior Airman Hodge testified that he was uncomfortable with his homosexuality, and he Dr. MC basically equated those two terms. Lastly, on harmless error, we argue that ambiguity was present, and that the members, it was very likely that the members were confused, and they equated that he couldn't control himself, impulse control, with homosexuality, and he ultimately did not receive a fair sentence. In conclusion, Your Honors, we argue that the military judge abused his discretion and failed to act as a gatekeeper in admitting this evidence against Senior Airman Hodge, the admission of which was highly prejudicial. Your Honors, if the decision below is affirmed, I see my time is up. I request a brief moment to conclude.
Please.
If the decision below is affirmed, this will be a radical departure from prior cases where these tools have come in the past. As such, we respectfully request that Senior Airman Hodge's sentence be vacated and he be granted a new sentencing hearing before the military judge. Thank you, Your Honors.
Government counsel, you may proceed.
Chief Judge Mayberry, members of the court, may it please the court, I am Captain Anne Delmar, here today with Colonel Julie Pivork, representing the United States. The sentence in this case should not be disturbed, as the military judge properly applied the Daubert framework, and he did not abuse his discretion after determining that the scientific evidence of the expert regarding recidivism was relevant and reliable. Even if this court were to determine that the military judge abused his discretion in this case when admitting this evidence, the appellant was not prejudiced by the admission of the evidence. Turning first to the proper admission of the evidence, the military judge went through a thorough analysis on the record, first considering Daubert and the four factors under Daubert, whether the theory had been tested, whether it had been peer-reviewed with substantial literature, whether there was a known error rate, and whether it experienced widespread acceptance in the scientific community. While it was not necessary to meet all of those necessarily, the military judge did determine that it met all the factors enumerated under Daubert. As such, this court should give the military judge's decision to admit this evidence great deference. The military judge then considered whether the expert had sufficient factual basis to comment on the evidence, looking under Ellis and Cass' decision in Stinson as well, and determined there was a sufficient factual basis, something that is not being contested here today, in that the expert considered the entire report of investigation and was present for the whole hearing, interviewed the victims, and observed the appellant's interview as well. Next, the military judge considered on the record RCM 1001B, whether the evidence was proper rehabilitative evidence, and determined that in line with previous cases such as Ellis in 2010, the CAF decision, that recidivism evidence is appropriate to be considered as to the appellant's rehabilitative potential. Other more recent courts, such as Merritt in 2015, a CAF case, Frey in 2014, also acknowledged the relevance of recidivism as to rehabilitative potential under RCM 1001B5. The military judge then next considered MRE 702 and determined that the expert met all qualifications under RCM 702 to render an opinion. They had specialized knowledge that would help the fact finder understand the evidence, specifically here, help the fact finder determine rehabilitative potential, that the expert had sufficient facts and data for his opinion to rely on, that the testimony was a product of reliable principles and methods based on the expert's education, training, experience, and the information the expert testified to in regards to he had had over 1,000 tests he had provided for recidivism. Previously, he had testified in all levels of other courts outside the military and inside the military. And then finally, that the expert had reliably applied these principles and methods to this case particularly.
And those, and the assessments in those other jurisdictions, sentencing proceedings or pre-sentencing is different, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, that would be correct, that we do, and I'm assuming Your Honor is referring to
for example, that Dr. MC testified, you know, where he had used this tool in over 1,000 cases, and that was, and sometimes to determine whether or not an offender should be eligible for parole, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, that's one of the reasons.
So it's not necessarily offered by a party.
No, so he testified that some states require just to see but whether someone should be committed for life, depending on their risk for recidivism. So it's used across other courts, not just for parole, not just for commitment hearings, but for sentencing as well. And so I believe some of the cases we've cited also have gone to, it's going to sentencing, an appropriate sentence in a case. The military judge next considered MRE 702, 705, and 403, acknowledging that it created a four-part test for experts' admissibility. He considered qualified to testify as an expert. Again, he determined that he was. The test was within limits of his expertise, which it was, and is not contested here today. There's a sufficient factual basis, and the danger of unfair prejudice did not outweigh the probative value, and he acknowledged his prejudice consideration on the record and determined that the probative value of this recidivism evidence to rehabilitative potential did not outweigh the danger of unfair prejudice. And again, that decision should be given deference since he acknowledged that consideration on the record.
So, counsel, why shouldn't we be concerned that the expert was unaware of any studies that accounted for the impact of the sexual orientation of the offender?
Your Honor, as the expert discussed, it's very well could be that had no effect on the test or the accuracy of the test. The test was designed to look at objective factors that you can look at a particular subject, and looking at the potential sexual orientation of that subject, it falls outside looking at those objective factors. And so It's not to say that that wasn't considered. This is a test that he described as having decades of research behind. He wasn't necessarily the creator of the test, but that's not required that was the creator of the test or that he was involved in the decades worth of research, testing, peer review, and studies. But that's not to say that it wasn't considered, but that just doesn't have any effect on the outcome and the reliability of this test.
Well, isn't it fair to say that because he wasn't aware of any studies, he didn't know what the impact of it was. He just wasn't aware that there was any impact. And he inferred from that that it was valid regardless of the orientation of the offender.
And that goes to say that, yes, he wasn't aware if there was any specific studies done on homosexual offenders, but then he went on to say that that's not necessarily going to have any effect on the outcome of this test because it doesn't look at that subjective factor. And then he also testified to, when he testified to the overarching branches of deviant sexual interest and impulse control, he explained how you could consider that sexuality on a more subjective scale, saying that it has nothing to do with homosexuality. It doesn't matter if you're gay or straight, but it goes to, if you're going to consider sexuality when it comes to recidivism, there is a way you could look at it. Is he comfortable with normal adult human relationships?
Is it fair to say that there's no relationship with sexual orientation when, I mean, isn't the clear implication that if this is a test that's applied for male offenders and the factor is whether a victim is male, isn't the fair inference of that is that it's going to impact homosexual offenders more than others?
Not necessarily, because there's nothing to say that who someone chooses as their victim necessarily goes to their sexual proclivities. So who the offender chooses to abuse, whether they abuse a male, then they're going to get that extra point. But if a homosexual male decides to abuse a female as his victim of sexual abuse, he's not going to get an extra point. So it's not necessarily to say that a homosexual offender is going to get that extra point.
So you don't see your relationship there?
There's nothing on the record that says that necessarily homosexual males tend to choose males as the person they're going to abuse. And further, the expert says that's what the science shows. So if that's the natural result that male offenders who choose male victims as their as the person they're going to abuse, they tend to have a higher degree of reoffending. So that's simply the science behind it. There's no bias behind it, but it's simply what the actuarial system says. So
would you agree that there's a distinction, though, between something that's scientifically valid and then something that we should tell the members in a court-martial they can consider when they're sentencing somebody?
Well, I think that goes to the weight, not the admissibility of this test. The defense had unfettered cross. They had the ability to show the shortcomings of this test, which has been articulated through case law back to Barefoot versus Estelle of the Supreme Court, noted that these actuarial tests aren't going to be perfect, but that doesn't make them inadmissible. It just goes to their weight, and the cross-examination, the adversarial system can parse out the potential shortcomings. As they did here, the defense had unfettered cross-examination in this case, and they did note that potentially that there wasn't a specific study that the expert was able to point to on whether that would make a difference.
And I don't mean to monopolize all your time, but I do have one more follow-up question. Suppose, and this isn't the case, this is hypothetical, but suppose the category wasn't the sex of the victim. Suppose it had to do, there was another category that had to do with either the ethnicity or the race or the religion of the offender, and that it turns out that there was, according to the science, some statistical relationship there that the expert would testify to. Would we be comfortable saying that the adversarial process is sufficient to account for that and that information should go to the members?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, in the Appellate Exhibit 76, it does say that it has been tested and specifically points out it's been tested against certain ethnicities and that ethnicity doesn't play a role in this test. So that's something that has been considered when looking at this test. But if it were to say that certain groups tend to parse out being higher, I think the test has looked into that to a great degree. And that's seen in Appellate Exhibit 76, where it shows that there are certain demographics that aren't appropriate for the test, or there's certain demographics that you could use the test for, but you should be aware that there's a variance in the error rate for those particular...
And I'm not suggesting that there are such correlations, but the hypothetical is if there were, would we be comfortable with that sort of consideration coming before the members?
If the science showed that certain demographics tend to offend more so than others? I don't believe so, Your Honor. It goes back to this being a scientific actuarial test and saying, not looking at any sort of subjective factors like that, but saying, of these objective factors, does this group tend to re-offend? And it looks within a certain degree of error. So if it was biased, then perhaps, but I think that the test they've looked into, it's been peer-reviewed, it's been scientifically vetted to ensure its reliability. One other thing I would like to note, Your Honor, is that the military judge, while he didn't specifically point to Hauser, he did go through all of the Hauser enumerated factors of Hauser when going through the other analysis, such as the qualification of the expert, the proper subject matter, proper basis under 702 and 703, relevant, reliable, and probative value outweighs the danger of unfair prejudice.
And counsel, I just want to kind of go back to the beginning where you mentioned RCM 1001. In what form does evidence of rehabilitative potential, how is that offered to the sentencing authority?
Are you referring to specifically the enumerated appropriate forms? So one of the forms, it does acknowledge that it can come in under expert testimony.
An expert what?
Testifying to various attributes of an accused as to their rehabilitative potential.
Correct.
As
to their rehabilitative potential.
And case
or
law.
Or risk of recidivism. I'm talking about case law, the rule itself.
It does allow for a case. Well, the rule itself, while it doesn't specifically enumerate the opinion of the expert, it does point that it is appropriate under 702 and 703. And looking at those rules, it does allow for opinion evidence to come
in. My question is, where in this record did Dr. MC offer an opinion of the appellant's risk of recidivism or rehabilitative potential?
And I would say, Your Honor, that he didn't offer an opinion. He commented on the evidence. So when he went through the static 2002 R test, he commented on the specific attributes of this particular defendant and how those can be indicators of recidivism. And he also went through some other things in the accused interview or the appellant's interview that pointed to risk of recidivism, but he didn't necessarily offer an opinion on what his risk was for
recidivism. So is it fair, in other words, he provided the members a substantial basis for an opinion, but never really gave one?
That's correct, Your Honor. He allowed that. He provided for the members to make that ultimate conclusion.
And is that a decision that a sentencing authority, in this case members, should be left to do given this type of information or evidence?
I believe the case law does establish that it is appropriate for the members to come to the appropriate decision on a member's rehabilitative potential, and these factors just help the members decide what that rehabilitative potential is.
So they should have reached their own expert opinion?
Not their own expert opinion, Your Honor, but the expert gave them the tools to consider different factors about this particular accused and his ability, his potential for reoffending.
Counsel, how would you respond to appellant's assertion that in making those comments on the application of the assessment tool in this case, Dr. MC changed the definition of what some of those factors were to include impulse control and his definition of deviance?
And the expert, I believe, clarifies that in the record when he says there's two overarching principles that all of this data falls under. It's that deviant sexual interest and the impulse control. And then all the factors that you find in this actuarial test stem from that overarching principle. And so there's many different ways, and he discussed a lot of different ways in the record of different indicators of sexual deviancy or deviant interest or sexual interests that are deviant from the fall under the overarching umbrella. So I believe that he addresses that pretty straightforward on.
So it's your position that he didn't change the overarching premise that the test was built on when he was applying it in this case, when he gave his definition of impulse control with regards to this appellant, or what deviant meant to him when he was assessing the results of the application of this tool in this case?
Correct, Your Honor. I think there's really two discussions he has. One is, let's look at this objective actuarial test and what you can glean from these very objective factors about this appellant. And then let's look at, using some of those underlying principles, let's look at what this particular appellant has said, getting more into more of a subjective analysis of who he is, his discomfort with his sexuality. And so he uses a lot of that terminology when discussing more of that subjective factor. I don't think that bleeds in or changes that actuarial test. Your Honor, if you have no further questions on that, I'll move to the prejudice discussion. The appellant was not prejudiced in this case, and for several reasons. First of all, the extra point he received for having a male offender didn't put him into any separate category. So at the end of the day, he would have scored as a low moderate, regardless of whether there was some sort of inaccuracy when it came to him reoffending, having a male.
Well, counsel, on that, I mean, isn't the clear implication of the expert's testimony that people who have this characteristic in their offense are more likely to recidivate than people who don't have this characteristic? Is that fair?
That's fair, but I think that actuarial test really boils it down to say, where do you fall on the spectrum of people who are going to reoffend? And for him, regardless, when you look at him overall, it's low moderate. And so when the expert went into a lot of those specifics under the test, let me explain to you why the age matters, let me explain to you why his relationship to these victims matter.
So is your interpretation that the expert was saying that somebody who scores a 4 and somebody who scores a 3 are equally likely to reoffend?
Essentially, the outcome of that test is they put him in about statistically the same spot of someone who's going to reoffend when it comes to a actuarial test. As we discussed, the defense had unfettered ability to cross-examine on this, to show to the members that they should get whatever weight they deem appropriate based upon them not being able to provide a specific study on it. And probably the most telling or powerful piece of evidence is that before the members was that this appellant had already reoffended, that he had 2 separate offenses over a several year span in front of them. The appellant pointed to the number of pages in this particular record, and it's not a very good reflection of this evidence. The record has, of those 33 pages, not all of it is on the actuarial test. A lot of it is discussing particular factors to this particular appellant that indicated recidivism. And you put that into the whole context of the government sentencing case. If this panel were to find that there was an abuse of discretion, we're to look at what was the effect in the context of the entire case. And what you had before you is not a lot of mitigating evidence from the defense, but you have a lot of powerful testimony from the government's case. You have 2 victims taking the stand under the oath, telling about their experience. You have the spouse of one of the victims. And then you have a lot of evidence that regardless of whether the actuarial test this court found isn't valid and appropriate, that was appropriate from the expert. The government doesn't challenge the appellant doesn't challenge the other information that this expert testified to, namely the specific factors he drilled down on that applied to this particular appellant as far as his risk for recidivism.
Well, on that point, it seems like there has been an argument that the expert relied on an ipsy-dixit basis for the judge to accept that this is scientifically valid and didn't provide enough underlying study or data to support that. Should we be concerned about that?
And I would disagree with that characterization of the expert's testimony. The expert discussed a lot of studies, not by name, but provided testimony that this is a widely reviewed, studied test. So as opposed to some instances where it was just the expert saying, we use this in this one particular situation, you have this expert in this test, in this case saying, we've used this across all sorts of courts. This has been widely tested for decades among many peer review panels, and there's nothing to necessitate him actually having to name by name each of those studies or reviews. So I don't think that's what the record actually shows, is that it's just based on his use or his belief.
But isn't that precisely the challenge that was made at the Daubert phase of this hearing? I mean, the defense was challenging the scientific reliability of this test, which is different from Ellis because there was no Daubert challenge in Ellis. So how do you believe the judge appropriately made that transition from the fact that Ellis said this kind of evidence is admissible to a case where we have, where the very foundation of the evidence is challenged, which did not happen in Ellis?
The military judge in this case, Your Honor, did do a thorough analysis under Daubert. He considered all those factors and determined that the contentions from the appellant in this case were ripe for cross-examination, but did not invalidate this test, did not make it reliable to use. So he did go through all those tests, he considered all these factors, and determined the test nonetheless was relevant, reliable, and could be properly challenged in the adversarial system by the defense. The defense had their expert there, the judge noted on the record, sitting at the table, available to cross-examine, available to even provide evidence, if there was such a thing, to invalidate the prima facie case the government had put forward that this was a valid test. And the appellant didn't do that. So there is no evidence before this court to say that this test is not valid.
So the absence of any studies that the witness could cite to you to support the validity of the test, you don't believe that that was anything that should have caused the judge to step back from where he started with a determination that Ellis said this comes in? I mean, in this case, they did challenge the expert witness's basis for saying that this is a reliable test. They asked him about the studies. What studies can you quote? What studies can you provide to us to establish that prong of this test? And as you indicated, he testified, well, he didn't have any, but he testified that there were there, and they all substantiate the validity of this particular test.
And I don't believe that the appellant contests that the test is valid and properly peer-reviewed outside of the one question about homosexuality. I think the military judge properly relied on the expert's testimony when he said that that doesn't necessarily have any bearing on the reliability of this test. There's numerous factors that go into this test. Not all of them are discussed, and just because they're not discussed doesn't necessarily mean that they have any effect on the test. And so the expert was to say, despite that challenge, this test is reasonable and reliable. It is appropriate for this particular accused. He falls under the enumerated factors in the test of who this test should be used on. So I think the judge properly considered that argument and determined based on the expert's testimony that it still was a reliable test. There's no further questions. Let me briefly conclude. The sentence in this case should not be disturbed, as the military judge did not abuse his discretion when admitting recidivism evidence through expert testimony, as he properly conducted a Daubert analysis and MR 403 prejudice analysis. Even if this court were to determine that the judge abused his discretion in this case, the appellant was not prejudiced by that decision.
Thank you, Bill.
Amicus counsel on behalf of the government, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Thorsten Sweiter, appearing as amicus curiae from Penn State Law, arguing in support of the government of the United States. Senior Airman Troy Hodge was convicted of a multi-victim sexual assault and sentenced by a panel of members. The members were aided in their sentencing determination through the use of the static 2002R, which, as we've covered, is an actuarial test that is part of a field of science known as predictive analytics. What predictive analytics attempts to do is use data and statistical calculations to quantify and predict what we previously might have thought in human behavior was unpredictable. Because it's scientific, it is objective and it is testable, and it was properly examined under Daubert at trial. And because the military judge in this case properly came to three conclusions, this court should affirm the military judge and the member's sentence for Airman Hodge. First, the military judge properly conducted a Daubert hearing. On the record, he identified all the relevant factors and stated that they had been met. Second, the military judge recognized that this evidence is exactly the sort of thing that is admissible under Rule Court-Martial 1001. And third, the military judge appreciated that this evidence was of substantial probative value and was not outweighed by any undue prejudice, and at worst had harmless error upon the members. And for these reasons, we request this court affirm Airman Hodge's sentence. As I previously stated, the static 2002R is part of predictive analytics. This sort of thing is not unique to the static 2002. This is seen in many other areas and industries now that technology has enabled us to examine a wide variety of statistical calculations. So we see this in economics and business, and my personal favorite, we see this a lot in baseball. Baseball teams now all have statistical departments that are using all the data that have been compiled for players and teams to predict future success and to see what correlates with winning and individual success. And in this case, the static 2002R uses that same methodology and that same philosophy to find out what about sex offenders makes them likely to reoffend again through a pure objective statistical analysis. This can be examined under Daubert, as the military judge did. First of all, the military judge's ruling should be afforded deference because, starting at page 940, the military judge, in making his rulings, identified each of the Daubert factors and stated they were met. This allows this court to see that the military judge knew the applicable law and was able to apply it properly to see that all of the Daubert factors, which are not exclusive and are flexible by the word of the Supreme Court itself, were met in this case, indicating that the evidence was strong and admissible. First, Dr. MC testified as to the extensive data and testing that has gone into the static 2002R and its other related family tests. Dr. MC spoke to 45,000 plus data points that had gone into the calculations spanning decades. Now, this is the life's work of Dr. Hansen, indicating that this has been tested extensively and is well known within the scientific community. Because these 45,000 data points are there over decades worth of research, it has a very well known and established error rate and validity. Dr. MC, in fact, provided two different measures by which the validity of the static 2002R has been tested and vetted. First, he talked about the D-score, which was 0.6 to 0.8. That was on starting in page 897 to 98. And then he also provided an illustrative example of what's called an ROC curve to state how and explain to the military judge so the military judge could understand how this sort of analytical tool has been vetted properly by the community. This means that there was substantial evidence on the record for the military judge to find out that it had been tested and that it had been properly vetted. Furthermore, Dr. MC was able to speak of its wide acceptance within the scientific community and the legal community. While it's been pointed out that he many times did not have specific studies to name, there is an exhibit on the record, Exhibit 75, which is a study that speaks about how this methodology is applied. And there's also was testimony about a 2015 study. This, in addition with Exhibit 76, the coding rules, where at the bottom there was listed a number of studies that had been going into the static line of tests, indicates that there is ample tests that had been specifically named within the record that support the use and testing and validity of this study. Beyond that, the military judge then also recognized that it was well accepted not only within the scientific community, but within the legal community. United States versus Ellis, the CAF case, opened the door for the static tests to be introduced within military courts, specifically under Rule 1001. But spanning back decades, we have seen numerous federal courts and state courts accept these actuarial models in a wide variety of contexts, indicating that numerous experts across all sorts of jurisdictions within the United States have accepted these models as valid scientific evidence for exactly the sort of proceedings that occur with sex offender sentencing and recidivism. Going on, military judge correctly identified, as I previously stated, that this evidence was admissible under Rule 1001. 1001 is meant to be read expansively. The Court of Military Appeals back in the 80s in Williams stated that 1001 is meant to be viewed expansively, and we have seen risk of recidivism as terms of rehabilitative potential numerous times as admissible evidence under that rule in cases such as Flesher and in Frey and even in Ellis, where Ellis specifically allowed the static 99 to be used under that. So in this case, the static 2002R falls squarely within accepted precedent of this sort of evidence being admitted under 1001. Beyond that, we have also spoken at length about how the military judge recognized that there was no undue prejudice, or at least that the probative value of this evidence substantially outweighed any prejudice. First of all, as we've stated, any prejudice can also be chalked up to be harmless error because a single point difference is all that mattered between this highly contested homosexuality issue that has been spoken by defense counsel.
Let me ask you, counsel. So would you agree with the statement that the implication of the expert's testimony is that somebody who scores a 4 is more likely to reoffend than somebody who scores a 3?
I don't believe that that is necessarily the implication, Your Honor, because the reason why these are in a range is because it bases upon these are sort of imprecise percentages that are the correlative factors. So 3 and 4 are grouped together for a reason. These tests are not formulated arbitrarily in the same reason that this point for any male victim, those words are chosen carefully by the creators so that it does not include or exclude anything that they don't want to be included or excluded by that. So it's a logical inference that that point is appropriately applied to Airman Hodge, just as Dr. MC speculated during his testimony at the Daubert hearing. Second of all, Your Honors, any prejudice that defense counsel brings up regarding talking about deviant sexual interest was actually cured in front of the members. In the record at page 975, Dr. MC was specifically asked by trial counsel, is this model passing judgment or making some kind of statement about homosexuality? Dr. MC said no. This model of Stat 2002R is not making some kind of social commentary. It is simply an objective observation based upon the numbers. So the members heard exactly what they needed to hear about how this evidence should be taken, and defense counsel was given ample opportunity to cross-examine to identify any weaknesses so that the members were able to see what weight to give it. Furthermore, after Dr. MC finished testifying, the military judge asked, members, do you have any questions? And the members have no questions. This indicates that we can safely infer that they were not confused or misled or otherwise improperly informed by Dr. MC's testimony because they had no follow-ups. They knew exactly what weights to provide.
Well, talk about weighing this evidence. The judge did acknowledge that it was very prejudicial. And at what point in the record did the judge, I guess, evaluate the probative value of this evidence?
To my knowledge, Your Honor, there is no specific point where the judge specifically listed factors that went to its probative value and then prejudicial value and then weighed the two of them together. But the record does support that the probative value is there and substantial. And because the judge did say, and he did recognize prejudice and did say that it was of great probative value, we can at least understand that the judge did consider it, even if he did not necessarily go at length to give us a long example. So we can safely conclude that he applied the law properly. And as a final point as to prejudice, Your Honor, United States versus Frey, a previous court, noted that the sentencing actually handed down by the members can be indicative of the presence of any prejudice. In this case, that can be very illuminating. Airman Hodge faced a maximum of 37 years for his multi-victim sexual assault. The government at sentencing requested 7 years, and he was ultimately given 5 years by the members. So this lighter sentence than what the government even indicated, even requested, is pretty indicative that the members were not unduly prejudiced against Airman Hodge. They went easy on him. You know, they gave the appropriate value given that there was also other testimony about victim impact and then Airman Hodge's own unsworn statement asking for their leniency. So there's no evidence on the record to indicate that the members were unduly prejudiced because they even gave a favorable sentencing to Airman Hodge. So for these three factors, Your Honor, because the military judge properly identified and applied the law under Daubert, under Rule 1001, and then the record supporting that there was no undue prejudice for the members when they made their sentencing determination, We respectfully request that this court affirm the member's sentence for Airman Hodge. Thank you.
I do have one question for you, counsel.
Sorry.
Please. If to go back to your point that the expert testified that what he was saying wasn't any sort of commentary on homosexuality per se, or sexual orientation. Given the facts of this case, wasn't there a clear link between sexual orientation and the offenses in this case that would have been apparent to the members?
Your Honor, there is a link that could be inferred, but I believe that that's a dangerous link to infer because it was never explicitly stated. Dr. Chambers specifically made that statement in front of the members to try to cut against that kind of inference, to say that, you know, Airman Hodge's sexuality was not an issue here. And the static 2002R is not attempting to pass judgment upon homosexuals. It is a mere reflection of what the data say. He, in fact, even tried to give a very sort of low-key explanation of it's like A plus B equals C, and we have the C here. And while the static 2002R doesn't explain why C is, it is a fact that is verified and objective based upon the data, and so the members were able to give that the proper weight. Unless there are no more questions, thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. Appellant's Counsel, you may close.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honors, not having a nefarious intention does not mean that there is not a prejudicial outcome. And here claiming that the intention of the test, that there is no intention of the test to artificially penalize and artificially inflate the risk of recidivism for a homosexual does not mean that that is not the same conclusion that the members were led to. Denying that this assessment had anything to do with appellant's sexual orientation is contrary to what is seen throughout the record. A significant portion of the testimony by Dr. MC really does go to the risk of recidivism, and particularly under this category of deviance. Dr. MC testifies with regard to this assessment specifically that he's done it over 1,000 times. He is a known prolific expert within the military justice system, but during his testimony he stated that he did it only in the military justice system 10 times and maybe 4 to 5 times for the government, which leads to the question to be raised as to why nowhere else and why specifically here. When you look at the other categories that appellant tested positively and received points in, one is age, is that he's a young age, which is very common among military members, common among offenders. When you look at the other category that he positively was marked in, one was being unrelated to the victim. So the third assessment, the only other category which brought up any discussion, which caused him to risk his recidivism, was specifically the male-to-male assessment, the male-to-male victim question, which indicates that there's a real possibility that this was only used because of that specific factor, which, while the government did not argue it in sentencing that he should be sentenced more harshly because he's a homosexual, it does leave that question of, well, if it doesn't matter, if it's not important, if he's in this low category, the slow to moderate category, what is the purpose of bringing this testimony in the first place? If not to talk about this factor, if not to talk about his risk of recidivism because he offended against a male, if not to talk about his homosexuality, his inability to come to terms with his homosexuality, as was brought up during the OSI interview.
But it was brought up by whom?
In the OSI interview, it was brought up by the appellant when he was speaking with the OSI agent.
And in this pre-sentencing, who brought that evidence before the sentencing authority?
They spoke specifically, the trial counsel in questioning Dr. MC talked about deviance and then led them to that male-to-male question. And while they may not have used the word homosexual initially for that, it was something that led the members to that conclusion. And eventually when they were talking about not just the deviance, but the other factors, his homosexuality was brought up by trial counsel. It was something that was addressed during his direct testimony.
But in pre-sentencing, Who brought that in an unsworn statement? It was appellant, correct?
His sexuality was brought out in an unsworn statement, but that was after the testimony of Dr. MC. It was
not discussed a static factor.
Dr. MC?
Correct.
He discussed that prior to the unsworn statement by the appellant. It was not rebuttal evidence. It was during the government's sentencing case in chief.
But my point is the pre-sentencing didn't end after Dr. MC's testimony.
No, Your Honor.
And so we're talking about literally and figuratively one point in the pre-sentencing session, right?
Yes, Your Honor, it is one point. But the concern with that one point is the category it falls under, the attention drawn to the fact that he is more likely to offend specifically because he has these male victims. It's the use of the word deviant 17 times, and it leads members, regardless of their previous opinions prior to walking into this courtroom, to believe that based on the testimony of a learned expert who was put in front of them by the court to explain this to them, that homosexuals therefore have a per se higher risk of recidivism, and that he should be punished based on that, that that is something to be considered in determining the appropriate sentence in his case.
In allowing this evidence, how did the military judge, again, commit manifest error?
The military judge was aware, based on the testimony of Dr. MC during the motion in limine and the Daubert hearing, that Dr. MC could not provide any studies. May I finish? Thank you, Your Honor. He wasn't able to provide any studies indicating that this wasn't a factor, that it didn't have an impact, and that his answer to all of these questions was accept the science, and therefore he was aware that there just wasn't the basis, there just wasn't the knowledge by the expert who was the proponent of this evidence that it could be appropriately applied in appellant's case. If there are no further questions?
No. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.
I want to thank all the counsel for their arguments today, and certainly thank you to Penn State Law for hosting us here. The court will render a decision in due course, and the court is now closed. Please remain seated.